This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. We're going to start the program today by recognizing an impressive milestone. Today, Queen Elizabeth becomes the longest reigning monarch in England's history. She passed Queen Victoria, who set a record of 63 years, 216 days. Queens, kings, monarchs, aren't these a thing of the past? The world has forgotten about royalty virtually everywhere else. But not so in Britain. And even though some people are unhappy about it, the British royal family keeps on keeping on. And we're going to talk about why that is the case. The big news in Europe is the flood of immigrants coming from the Middle East and elsewhere. This is swamping the news cycle in Europe. It has major implications for Europe for years to come. It's important for Americans and other outside observers to recognize just how big this story is. And we're going to talk to Brad McDonald, who lives in Britain, who travels to Europe quite a lot. He's going to give us a firsthand view of the situation and help us to get a sense of why it's so concerning and what it means for Europe's future. In the United States, the Environmental Protection Agency just made a stunning power grab. It reviewed the Navigable Waters Act, and it realized that navigable waters include just about everything bigger than a puddle and about 4,000 feet in every direction away from it. We're going to talk about what they're trying to do here and who's excited about it and who is vehemently opposed to what the EPA is doing. We're going to talk about why this could be big trouble for America's economy. And then at the end of the program, I'm going to give you some pretty simple advice. I want to talk about the last thing you should do at night that will really make your day. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. Today, September 9th at 5:30 p.m. in England, Queen Elizabeth will become the longest reigning monarch in English history. She will pass Queen Victoria's record of 63 years and 216 days. She's already the world's oldest serving sovereign. And since she took the throne in 1952, this woman has seen and done an awful lot. She's given her assent to more than 3,500 acts of parliament. She has conferred over 400,000 honors and personally presided over 610 investitures. She's a patron of over 600 charities and organizations. She has visited over 116 countries, making her the most traveled monarch in history. She was Britain's first monarch to have made state visits to China and Russia. She was the first British monarch to set foot in the Republic of Ireland since 1911. When her grandfather, George V, visited it, it was part of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland. She's 89 years old, and she's still traveling. She plans to fly to Malta in November for a Commonwealth event. And in her time on the throne, she has seen 12 different British prime ministers in office, back to Winston Churchill, through Margaret Thatcher, David Cameron. Tony Blair was actually born while she was on the throne. Also, in her time on the throne, there have been 12 American presidents and 7 popes. It gives you an idea of just how long-lasting her reign has been. And a lot of people have said over the years that the British royal family is a thing of the past. It's washed up. It's irrelevant to modern times. It shouldn't have any role, really, in today's Britain. But it keeps on going. And Queen Elizabeth's extraordinary longevity and the length of her time as queen, it's just one example. But you look at just how much the public loves the royal family and just adores the royals. The fact that back in 2011, when Prince William and Catherine Middleton were married, there were about 2 billion people that watched the wedding. The public is fascinated with the royal baby and everything that's going on with the royal family. Why has Britain's throne endured when virtually every other monarchy in the world has been overthrown or faded into obscurity? Why? Well, at the Trumpet, our interest in this subject is far from being just a fascination with celebrity. There aren't a lot of people who talk about this, but if you do a little bit of digging, it doesn't take a whole lot of digging to look at the roots of the royal family, and you realize there's something very unusual and very inspiring about Britain's monarchy. And a milestone like the one that the Queen is reaching today, it brings that reality forcibly to mind. What do you know about the history of Britain's royal family? After the royal wedding in 2011, the Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Flury, wrote an article called "The Most Inspiring Part of the Royal Wedding." And I want to just read a portion of this article to you. He wrote this: "To understand England's royal family, we must understand a promise God made to King David, recorded in 2 Samuel chapter 7. Now, when you look at that chapter, there's a description there about how God inspires David to build him a house or a temple in Jerusalem. And even though David was the one who started that project, he made the decision to build the temple, it wasn't until his son, Solomon, that it was actually constructed. But you can see God's promise to David. It starts in verse 12 of 2 Samuel 7. It says, "And when thy days be fulfilled, and thou shalt sleep with thy fathers, I will set up thy seed after thee, which shall proceed out of thy bowels, and I will establish his kingdom." And God is talking there about Solomon, David's son. In verse 13, God says of Solomon, "He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever." I'll establish the throne of his kingdom forever. God actually promised to establish David's royal throne through Solomon forever. And that promise gets even more specific. If you read the verses after that, verses 14 through 16, God says, "I will be his father, and he shall be my son. If he commit iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men and with the stripes of the children of men. But my mercy shall not depart away from him, and thine house and thy kingdom shall be established forever before thee. Thy throne shall be established forever." Now, that is an amazing promise. It says if the royal family disobeys God, he's going to chasten them, but he will never break this covenant. He'll never take away this throne. And this article by Gerald Flury says this: if you believe God, and millions of people say they do, this means the royal line of David must still exist today. Now, of course, a lot of people look at the Bible and dismiss that type of thing. Well, you can't take that literally. I mean, forever, you know, or not even believing that there was a God that made that kind of a promise. But you look at that promise, it is very strong. It's very specific. And guess what? It's also backed up in several other places in Scripture. I want to read to you probably the strongest of these other places. It's in Jeremiah chapter 33. And verses 20 and 21, it says this: "Thus saith the Lord, if you can break my covenant of the day and my covenant of the night, and that there should not be day and night in their season, then may also my covenant be broken with David, my servant, that he should not have a son to reign upon his throne." So there, God is basically saying, if you still see the sun rising in the morning, then you can be sure that there is still a descendant of King David sitting on this royal throne. That's an amazing promise. And as far as I know, the sun is still coming up. There's still day and night in their season. Now, the amazing thing is, historians have tracked what became of that throne after Solomon. Obviously, you can follow it just in the Bible, down through the kings that reigned in Jerusalem over the kingdom of Judah about 400 or 500 years after God made that promise. But you can also follow it even further down through one of the daughters of the last king of Judah, Zedekiah. This woman traveled to Ireland when Judah went into captivity, and the royal line was preserved, and it was actually transplanted to the British Isles. Now, this might seem controversial, but there is a lot of proof for this, and the royal family itself acknowledged this truth until quite recently. If you just even look into the details of Queen Elizabeth's coronation back in 1953 and everything that happened when she was crowned, that ceremony is loaded with similarities to the way that Solomon and the monarchs of Israel were crowned anciently. Here's another quote from this article by Gerald Fleury. For over 70 years, we have proved repeatedly and in convincing detail that Britain descends from ancient Israel, specifically the tribe of Joseph. Among the descendants of Israel, England has by far the most enduring and prestigious monarchy. The reason for this is simple and stunning. England's royal family descends from King David. And he says that this institution is living, breathing proof of God's existence. If you think about it, those promises that were made in the Old Testament, the promises that God gave to King David, if they are fulfilled, that is dramatic proof of the presence of a living God. And it's an awesome subject to look into. It's a subject that really does build your faith. It builds your confidence in the authority of the Bible, builds your faith in the God who made those promises to King David. And what's especially awesome is when you look into the Bible about what the future of that royal throne is going to be. It does say that there is going to be a difficult period that the royal family will go through in the short term. You remember when God told David that if they obeyed him, he would chasten them, and he is going to make good on that promise as well. There's definitely plenty of evidence to show that Britain and its royal family are in for some tough times. But ultimately, what will happen with that royal line and with that throne is just full of spectacular hope. And I want to encourage you to read the promise that was made about Jesus Christ. You can read it in Luke chapter 1 and verses 31 through 33. This is what that passage says. This is an angel talking to Mary who gave birth to Jesus Christ. And behold, you shall conceive in your womb and bring forth a son and shall call his name Jesus. He shall be great and shall be called the Son of the Highest. And the Lord God shall give unto him the throne of his father David, and he shall reign over the house of Jacob forever, and of his kingdom there shall be no end. You know, this isn't just a promise in a couple of obscure passages in the Old Testament. This is a prophecy that was given to the mother of Jesus Christ, and there are other passages, significant passages in the New Testament that back this up as well. That throne is still going to be around, and God is going to give it to Christ, who is also of the royal line of David. If you just look at that throne on earth today, its existence actually points to the time when Jesus Christ returns, the second coming of Jesus Christ, because he is going to rule from that very throne. If you've never studied into the truth about the British throne, please go to thetrumpet.com and look at our lead story, The Inspiring Truth About Queen Elizabeth, the Longest Reigning Monarch in English History. We have links there to several articles that will teach you about this and give you the details, and also a link to a fantastic book written by Herbert W. Armstrong, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, which tells the remarkable story about the British throne. Oh,
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The big news in Europe is the immigration crisis, a flood of immigrants coming from the Middle East and elsewhere outside the European Union. Once they arrive within the EU, they can go anywhere. A lot of countries within Europe are struggling to deal with this mass of humanity that's coming in there. The Schengen area, it includes 26 European countries. There is no passport control, no border control at their common borders. And so these folks can go wherever they want to go within that area. We've been talking about this a lot on the program. Stephen Fleury has talked about it on the Trumpet Daily. I wanted to bring Brad McDonald into the discussion via Skype from our office in the UK. Mr. McDonald, in America, we're focusing on our own immigration problems. They're filling a lot of headlines here. But can you give us a sense of what it's like over there, how big this story really is within Britain and within Europe right now?
Well, the subject of immigration is already a hot topic here in Britain. Britain is not nearly as receptive to immigrants as Germany and some of the European countries are. I think Germany has said that they're happy to accept 500,000 a year for the next few years, or at least one of their politicians said that. That's just not the case here in Britain. There's in general just a real reticence to accept any of these refugees. Now, that changed last week, and it really changed as the result of that photo that was just beamed around the world of a little toddler washing up on the shores of Greece or Turkey, I forget where it was. That photo made its way onto the front page of newspapers here in England, and obviously a lot of people were moved emotionally, and that kind of set off a stronger argument for accepting refugees, at least accepting more women and children. And I think Prime Minister Cameron has come around and is now talking about doing that.
An article that Thomas Sowell wrote Tuesday, just this week, he said this: no nation has an unlimited capacity to absorb immigrants of any sort, and especially immigrants whose cultures are not simply different, but antagonistic to the values of the society in which they settle. He said the inescapable reality is that it is an irreversible decision to admit a foreign population of any sort, but especially a foreign population that has a track record of remaining foreign. He's talking about the fact that this is going to affect and transform Europe culturally in a way where you look at, say, an image that evokes a lot of emotion and that causes a policy decision that says, okay, we're going to accept this many more because we want to avoid little boys washing up on the shore. That cannot be reversed. And those people who come in, they stay and they import their foreign culture. This is transformative in terms of Europe's future.
Absolutely. And the point Saul makes there, I don't think most Europeans see that yet. There's still too much emotion. There's still too many images of refugees suffering. And I think that there's not enough recognition of the long-term consequences socially, culturally, financially, politically of accepting these refugees. People, a lot of Europeans haven't yet realized that their morality is going to be limited by realities. That's inevitable. Europe and Europe's leaders will have to come face-to-face with the realities before long.
It's one thing when you're talking about a young child or you're talking about women, but as far as I understand, it's really a lot of young men who are coming in. And Stephen Fleury was even talking on his program on Tuesday about the fact that it's even a lot of economic opportunism, that it's not necessarily just fleeing from warfare, but it's just wanting better economic opportunity.
Absolutely. I think photos of suffering women and children help newspapers sell. But the reality is that young, strong men generally have a much better chance of surviving the dangerous trek from North Africa or the Middle East to Europe. I've read one or two stories talking about how a lot of husbands and a lot of fathers are leaving their wives and children home and coming to Europe, which, you know, you think about the consequences for places like Libya or Syria or some of these other countries in North Africa and the Middle East. I mean, that portends a demographic crisis down the road if this trend continues and if we see, you know, a large portion of young men relocate to Europe.
Well, we've been talking about Europe's demographic problem with Islam for quite some time. And this is just taking this whole crisis to another level in very rapid fashion.
Right. Now, a lot of pro-immigration pundits are making that exact point. You know, they're saying, listen, look at the birth rates in Germany and in France. We need people. You know, most of the birth rates in Europe aren't even at replacement levels. So Europe is facing a demographic crisis, and a lot of people are saying, well, this is the solution if we need to accept some of these immigrants or all of these immigrants, and you know, we can bring them into the workforce and we'll be able to sustain our country and sustain our economies.
Which might be a viable argument if they were becoming European, but when you have, you know, the birth rates, say, you know, statistics like the most common name of given to newborns in the country is Muhammad, and you're talking about Germany and you're talking about France, and just how much the Islamic peoples within those countries are overwhelming. It's Europeans, they're happy with one kid, but the Muslims coming in, they want 6, 7, 10.
Right. Well, those people, I mean, of course, they're underestimating human nature. They don't take into account the fact that like you alluded to, that the refugees coming into Europe, they're Muslim. They have a whole different set of values than the average European. They're not talking as much about that. They're not talking about the fact that these refugees will be a country within a country. There'll be a people within a people. They certainly won't identify with what's in Germany's national interest, or France's national interest, or Christian Europe's national interest. Those imports will identify with, you know, what's in their national interests and even what's in the national interests of the country that they left.
We're talking with Brad McDonald, and he wrote an article on thetrumpet.com called Europe's Intractable Crisis. The subhead is Solving the Refugee Crisis Requires Fixing Problems That Are Beyond Our Ability to Fix. I'd like to just read a quote from your article and then just have you comment on it. Brad says, honestly, I think most people haven't yet fully comprehended how serious, how perilous, how incurable this crisis is. You're commenting on this right now, just the fact that it's almost a failure of imagination to recognize what's really going on here, getting caught up in maybe the emotions of it, but not paying attention to what some of the long-term consequences could be. The quote continues, right now there's a lot of emotion and not enough serious thought and understanding. That spells disaster. The understanding will come, but it will come too late. It will come after Europe is on fire. I guess the question is, what is it going to take to wake Europeans up? I mean, the way that you're talking about it right now, it sounds like there's just a real failure to recognize what's going on here.
Well, there's just a lot of emotion and not enough reasoning. Not enough people are setting aside the emotion and just asking basic questions. You know, who is going to pay for the food and the lodging of these refugees? It sounds like a somewhat inappropriate question or a calloused question, but living costs money. Someone has to pay for the food. Someone has to pay for the homes. Someone has to pay for the clothes. Someone has to pay for the medical treatment that these people will need. Who's going to pay for that? Europeans are taxed heavily. European governments have massive debt. Where's the money going to come from? What's going to happen if crime rates go up? But then you could also think about, well, what happens when you stick ethnic Muslims or ethnic Syrians next door to ethnic Germans? You have two different cultures, two different peoples, two different religions. There will inevitably, at least in some places, there will inevitably be conflict and tension.
Well, you have to view it even in the context of, say, like the Charlie Hebdo attack and the
right.
So many of these incidents where you already see that conflict taking place, and this seems like this is only going to exacerbate that.
Absolutely, absolutely. And then something else to think about is this issue of precedence. If Europe, if Germany accepts 500,000 Syrian refugees, on what grounds could they reject 100,000 Nigerian refugees, mm-hmm. or 50,000 Libyan refugees, or 75,000 Moroccan refugees? Why should one refugee be accepted and another rejected? At what point will Germany, at what point will Europe draw the line and say, we've got enough?
Well, not to mention the fact that you would have some people in the Middle East who have openly stated the fact that they view Europe as a target, and they actually are trying to undermine and attack Europe from within, and they would use this opportunity as these refugees are flooding in. I mean, we've talked about similar types of scenarios in the United States with immigrants coming in from the South,
right.
that they would actually use this as an opportunity to embed themselves within Europe and could stage attacks in the future.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, this is a legitimate question that not enough pundits are talking about, because it seems calloused to talk about that question on television after you've shown an image of suffering migrants. But it's a real question. How many thousands of ISIS terrorists are coming up through Turkey and then the Balkans into Germany and France? It's a real question. It's a real issue. And I think, you could safely say that it already has happened.
Well, what's your sense of – there are these attacks on refugee hostels and camps within Europe, and there is some rhetoric coming from some European leaders about how we're going to accept Christians but not Muslims, or they're not going to find much of a home here. How much are they on the fringe? Is it more of the mainstream view, more of the publicly accepted view that, we need to be accommodating and so on, or is it becoming – is it kind of shifting to where this hostility is becoming more mainstream?
My feeling is that it varies by nation. If you look at some of the Balkan countries, I think the general public tends to be pretty anti-immigrant or anti-migrant. They are against it. And the politicians in the Balkans, Hungary, Bulgaria, they are pretty staunchly against the inflow of the migrants, or they're very quick to let them come in but then put them on a train out. Now, as you move more into Northern Europe, in general, they aren't as staunchly against the immigrants. But I do think over time, as these Northern European countries, as they come to experience the consequences of accepting hundreds of thousands of refugees, and as their peoples, the German people and the French people, as they come to realize the consequences of accepting 500,000 and eventually 1 million and then 2 million immigrants, I think it's bound to happen. An anti-immigrant rising is bound to happen. Of course, it exists already, but I think it's a trend that will only intensify as the problem and as the issues that are associated with the influx of these refugees hits closer to home in Germany, France, the Scandinavian countries.
You make an excellent point, and you've made this point about over the years how much it's not difficult to imagine a story or two or five emerging of immigrants who were part of this flood while they came into the country and then they attacked. Maybe they kill somebody on the street, or they blow up a deli and there's 15 people killed or something like that. News hits And it's people make the link between, oh, we were soft on immigration and we let these people come in and look what they're doing to our country. And suddenly the public opinion begins to shift dramatically.
Right. Yeah, you're really talking about Europe's 9/11. Yeah, at some point, it's inevitable that there's a major terrorist attack in Berlin or Paris. I mean, there has been one in Paris. I mean, we had these radical Islamist terrorists earlier this year shoot people in the streets. But at some point, there's going to be a large attack. It's going to be a result of terrorists who either came in through the soft borders there in the Balkans or from North Africa. And I think there will be an awakening across Europe. When that awakening happens, European countries are going to find themselves in a difficult position because there will already be a huge number of immigrants living that they've already said yes to, living. So they're going to kind of have this moment where they want to get tougher. They want to be a little bit more confrontational with Islam. But at the same time, you know, a sizable chunk of their population is going to be Muslim.
Well, thank you, Brad. We appreciate your insights. We've been talking with Brad McDonald. He has an article on thetrumpet.com called Europe's Intractable Crisis. Solving the refugee crisis requires fixing problems that are beyond our ability to fix. You can find it online at thetrumpet.com. Thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
One of the most significant trends that we've been following here in America is the way that the current presidential administration is taking power to itself contrary to the law of the land. And most recently, in one of the most stunning grabs for power, we saw the Environmental Protection Agency earlier this year. They revisited the Navigable Waters Act, and they found that this act gives them a whole lot more power than they had ever realized before. We talked about it a little bit last week on our Week in Review program. I have Robert Morley here with me, who has written about this on thetrumpet.com. Robert, can you tell us what happened with what the EPA did on August 27th?
Sure. On August 27th, a judge, federal court in North Dakota, finally issued a ruling on the challenge to the EPA's new interpretation of the Navigable Waters Act, or the Clean Waters Rule, as it's being called. And basically, the judge came down and said what the EPA is doing with its new rules is violating the constitutional rights of the states. It said that it was putting a clear burden on the states that was not justified based on their jurisdiction. And he said that, in his opinion, this rule would not stand, could not stand. And he issued a preliminary injunction against them from implementing this rule.
Okay, so first of all, what was he concerned about and what was he saying would violate the states' rights so much?
Right. Well, basically, the Navigable Waters Act, the way it works is it gives the EPA authority to regulate any waters that can be navigated. You put a boat on it and it can be used for interstate trade, which is where the authority comes from, regulating interstate commerce.
And just give us an idea of what sort of regulations you might be talking about.
Sure. So environmental compliance regulations. So if you're a farmer, for example, and you fertilize your fields. Now, any runoff that comes from your fields could potentially be that hits a creek that eventually makes it into a river. Any manure runoff from your cattle could fall under pollution guidelines based from the EPA.
So they would be able to say, you've got to get some of these cattle off of here, or you have to use this type of fertilizer versus this type, or this is how much you can use.
Yeah, exactly. Or you're not allowed to have this much runoff coming off your fields, do something different. Or if you're a real estate developer, you have to you can't drain. You have to have your drainage going this way or that way, or you're having too much dirt coming off, sediments coming off your streets and hitting the watersheds. You need to do a study first, and you have to conduct extra compliance to meet our regulations. And this can create an incredible burden, as business owners know. I think the average cost for compliance and pulling an EPA permit under the Navigable Waters Act is about $270,000. So this is a huge compliance. I think the least expensive permit that the EPA issues across all permits costs on average about $17,000. So this isn't an insignificant burden on businesses around the United States.
And essentially, the way that they've redefined what navigable waters are, it would hit a whole lot of businesses that have nothing to do with water.
Oh, absolutely. If you look at what they are now regulating, most Americans, when they think navigable, they think boats. But basically what it comes down to, as they're now saying, is that they have the regulatory authority to govern streams and ditches, gullies, swamps, and even seasonal waters that dry up part of the time they aren't there. Ditches, drainage ditches. On their website, they actually had to post, because there was so much concern from the public, that they have no intention of regulating quote-unquote puddles or quote-unquote most ditches. But I find that kind of disturbing, that they'd even have to go to that level to say that they're not planning on regulating most ditches. To me, that's a pretty incredible statement for what they are trying to regulate under this act.
Just to put everyone's minds at ease. You guys can you can do with puddles what you'd like to do.
Right. Pacific Legal called it undoubtedly the largest expansion of power ever proposed by a federal agency. Senator James Lankford from Oklahoma, he called it. He said that the federal government is interpreting laws in no way that any president has ever attempted to interpret in the past. And that's the type of language that's characterizing what the EPA is trying to accomplish here.
So this federal judge says, whoa, 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 we cannot let you do this. This is way beyond your congressional mandate, your congressionally given authority. So then what happened?
So the EPA didn't like that, as you can imagine. They basically came out and said, okay, if the judges rule against us here, for now we'll comply with that. And those 13 states that brought the specific challenge, we won't implement it there. But for the rest of the United States, we don't care if the judge thinks it was unconstitutional. We're pushing forward with this. The Hill said the EPA characterized the EPA's reaction as defiant against the courts, and just saying that they're going to push ahead and force it on the rest of the country. And what's interesting about this is that virtually every business group across the United States has come out against it. Golf course owners have associations have come out against it. You name it. They're against it. And nobody wants this law. This is what makes this different from the recent carbon dioxide rules that the EPA proposed. At least with those, there was a lot of business owners and groups that came down on the side of the EPA. But with this one, there was no mandate. Nobody wanted it except for the radical left groups, Sierra Club, those types that are very, very much for increasing federal government authority.
And essentially, these groups, they're looking to put more power in the hands of this, in the hands of the EPA, really as a check against any kind of industrial expansion or business expansion. I mean, they're really wanting to put the brakes on economic expansion within the United States.
Yes, these environmental groups, they see economic growth as kind of an evil, because they see that it's connected to this economy of pollution, as they call it, the pollution economy that pollutes our environment. So they don't like to see economic growth in general. In some ways, they wouldn't come out and say that, but that's what their actions really show.
And the business owner who is trying to get some startup business going and trying to jump through all of the hoops that are put in front of him in order to make any headway, he would certainly view it that way, that essentially, what are these people trying to do other than shut me down?
Absolutely. And this also was something that Senator Lankford brought out and highlighted. He just said that, why aren't we getting the small businesses starting up the way we have in the past? He said, something's happened in these past 8 years. And I know I'm sure he was referring to President Obama's administration, but the facts speak for themselves. There has not been the startups, as we would have expected, and other recoveries from small business. They're just not there. And he says it's because we have this growth of bureaucracy and government and red tape. Example, EPA with these new guidelines. and it's prohibiting small business owners from even attempting.
Do you have any sense of, say, when the EPA will administer a regulation and a business owner is suddenly forced to comply with this, what's the any evidence of how reasonable those things are? My sense is that in a lot of cases, the regulator is basically like, here's what you have to do, you figure it out. And they're not concerned really about the practicalities involved.
Well, if you look across the country, obviously things are getting done. Businesses are able to make some progress, but, you know, they are complying with these laws. For example, I think the average time it takes for compliance with the EPA Navigable Waters Act is around 3 years to get all the permits and do the studies and that sort of thing. So they're definitely an inhibitor for economic growth. In the past, the EPA were staffed with scientists and civil servants who were there to, as their name, you know, really brings out, serve the community, serve the people that they're working towards. But now if you look, you know, from the top down, we're seeing increasing numbers of activists, people appointed these positions, not because of what they've done for the economy to help the economy or how they've served in the past. It's because of what they've been able to accomplish on the activist front. And Gina McCarthy, she's a case in point. She's not necessarily a scientist. She's some science background. She's more of a lawyer. And she has, you know, worked with activist organizations. And when she came to power, when she was appointed by President Obama in 2010, she was specifically said, if you think that I'm coming here to wait on Congress to pass laws, you've got another thing coming. I've come here to get things done, and I'm going to push the bounds of what authority resides in the EPA. And this is exactly what we are seeing.
Same mindset that the president has.
Well, President Obama was an activist, community organizer.
So just out of fairness, do you have any idea in these cases where there are obviously businesses who they're thinking about the bottom line, they're thinking about making money, and there could very well be ramifications environmentally from some of the choices that they make that could have adverse effects on the environment? I know that this would be something that would be impossible to quantify, but I just wonder to what degree those regulations would actually be beneficial and to what degree you could look at them and say, look, this is really intended to just arrest in economic development more than it is to protect anything.
Well, everybody likes clean water. I don't think there's, you know, that's something that goes across party lines. And I brought this out in my article. Democrats, Republicans, when you poll people, one of the things that they're most unified on is people want clean water, even more than clean air. But what's interesting about this is the opposition to this also crosses party lines. This wasn't something that people wanted. And it's not even politically. There's Democrats and Republicans coming together to fight this ruling. And one of the chief lines of evidence that they use to fight against this is that states are doing a fine job on their own regulating the waters. They don't need the federal government to step in and tell them what they can and cannot do. Why does a government bureaucrat, why is he smarter than the state bureaucrats? Mm. Why does some guy that's appointed to come in suddenly know more than everybody else in the country about how things should be regulated? You know, we appoint, you know, for example, Gina McCarthy. Now suddenly she knows better than everybody else that's been doing this? Well, I don't think so. And that's what the states are saying. I don't think that the federal bureaucrats know more than the rest of the country. And things are working just fine as they are.
So the way that they're redefining their jurisdiction and what falls under their regulatory power, what's the extent of land that we're talking about now?
Yeah. So this, as I said before, is one of the most expansions, one of the largest expansions of federal power potentially ever, at least as it pertains to the environment. So for example, the American Farm Bureau Federation says that this new law basically puts 99% of Pennsylvania and Montana under the EPA's authority. It puts about 100%, slightly under 100% of Virginia under the federal government's authority. So all told, this is talking about hundreds of millions of acres that the EPA was not the regulatory government agency responsible for, that they're now claiming jurisdiction over. So this is vast. This is huge. This is talking about waters. This is oceanic in proportion.
Well, thank you for bringing this to our attention, Robert. You've written an article. It's on thetrumpet.com. The title is The EPA's Waters of the United States Rule sunk by judge, but federal power grab is full steam ahead. That's a mouthful, Robert, these titles that you're giving us. But check that article out on thetrumpet.com to learn more about this amazing power grab by the EPA as part of a really a dangerous trend happening government-wide. I appreciate you coming in.
You're welcome.
It's time for today's last word.
Good news! Scientists have found a gene that enables those who have it to perform extremely well on 6 hours of sleep a night. Bad news is it's found in less than 3% of people. For the other 97% of us, 6 hours isn't nearly enough. Do you get enough sleep? Most people don't. Research says the average adult needs 7 to 9 hours a night. Teens need 8.5 to 10, yet 3 in 7 Americans aged 13 to 64 say that on weeknights they rarely or never get a good night's sleep. In related news, Americans drink on average 3 12-ounce caffeinated beverages every weekday. The quality of your sleep significantly affects the quality of your life. Evidence overwhelmingly shows that proper sleep makes you mentally sharper, increases your concentration, improves your emotional balance and creativity, enhances your physical performance, makes you a more productive worker, and even helps you prevent you from gaining weight. Nothing else delivers quite the benefits that adequate sleep does. While you sleep, your brain is amazingly busy. It's performing biological maintenance. It's keeping your mind and body running in top condition and preparing you for the day ahead. It all hinges on one predominant factor: going to bed on time. Far too many of us just don't do that. Some people pride themselves on being able to perform well on less sleep. Well, it turns out many of us can, sporadically. The Society of Neuroscience found that a sleep-deprived person can actually deliver similar results to a well-rested person, but he can't sustain it, and for a very specific reason. We all lose focus at times, but brains that are sleep-deprived are unable to refocus as quickly as well-rested brains. A sleep-deprived person experiences near-normal brain function, interspersed with brownouts in attention and severe drops in visual processing. It's like your body is compensating for lack of sleep by taking micro-naps. Researchers have found that for every lost hour of uninterrupted sleep, workers spend 12 more minutes per hour cyber-loafing, using company time to check personal emails and so on. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimate that 40.6 million American workers, 30% of the civilian workforce, doesn't get enough rest. Harvard scientists estimated in 2011 that sleep deprivation costs U.S. companies $63.2 billion in lost productivity per year, mainly because of presenteeism as opposed to absenteeism. People showing up but turning in subpar work. What exacerbates this effect is that sleep-deprived people don't notice their decrease in performance. They function normally enough that they have a false sense of their own competency. Research at Harvard and Berkeley has also revealed an amazing side effect of pulling an all-nighter: short-term euphoria. A sleepless night increases your body's dopamine levels. This chemical surge may briefly boost motivation and positivity, but it encourages ill-founded optimism, addiction, and impulsive behavior because the regions of your brain that are responsible for planning and evaluating decisions just shut down. The pathway where dopamine travels is called the mesolimbic pathway. Some research indicates that frequently overstimulating this pathway by sleep deprivation can permanently hamper your brain's neuroplasticity, its ability to adapt to new situations. Among college students, for example, 4 years of repeated sleep deprivation can have serious long-term consequences, including neurological degeneration. So here's the take-home lesson. It's simple, but fiendishly difficult. Go to bed when you know you should. God designed us to require a certain amount of sleep. Have you ever thought about that? Have you ever thought about why God never sleeps? It says in Isaiah 40 and verse 28, but we require several hours of unconsciousness. Surely God had several reasons for creating us this way. Maybe he used it to keep us humble, to remind us that while human, we are limited. It's certainly also a means of developing character, making choices to use our waking hours wisely and to exercise discipline in our bedtime. Some people think they can catch up on lost sleep over the weekend. Not true. In fact, according to the book Chronotherapy, sleeping late on Saturdays only lets your sleep clock drift later, making it even harder to wake up on Monday. So what do? Few of us have the option of sleeping in indefinitely. Our real choice comes several hours before that at bedtime. So obey this law of health and go to bed on time. Your quality of life depends on it. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to read the stories that we talked about today. We'll even give you a free subscription to our monthly news magazine, The Philadelphia Trumpet. You can contact us by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Follow us on Twitter @@thetrumpet_com. We're also on Facebook and Google Plus. Just search for The Philadelphia Trumpet. I want to thank my guests today, Brad McDonald and Robert Morley. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from the great philosopher Stephen Wright. You can't have everything. Where would you put it? Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice 101.3 KPCG and on the web at kpcg.fm.